This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, The Poet's Revenge. Whatever your opinion of our current president, one thing's for sure. The man can boast. I could play you clips of him saying he's a genius and that his nuclear button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's and all that. But you've already heard it, so I'll spare you. This podcast is largely a Trump-free zone, but put him in the back of your mind as we talk about Ozymandias by the great romantic Percy Bysshe Shelley. The poem is 200 years old, and it's one of the most famous sonnets in the language. Joining me in his apartment in New York City to talk about it is David Mikix, a scholar and professor who wrote about the poem in The Art of the Sonnet, a book he co-authored with Stephen, now Stephanie Burt. We excerpted the part about Ozymandias as a poem guide that's up on our site. David, tell us about the circumstances behind the writing of this poem. What was Shelley up to? What was going on?
Well, at this point, Shelley was living in the countryside north of London with Mary Shelley, his wife, and with Mary's relative, Claire Claremont. Mm-hmm. And Shelley was very enthusiastic about some recent news of discoveries in Egypt. The Italian explorer slash adventurer slash scoundrel Belzoni had succeeded in getting a fragmentary head of the pharaoh Ramses II from Thebes in Egypt. And the head had not yet come to England, but Shelley had heard about it. He actually never saw it. It's now in the British Museum. It appeared a few months after Shelley left England forever. In early 1818. But Shelley had heard the news of it. So on Boxing Day, that is the day after Christmas in England, he and his friend Horace Smith, who was an investor and a poet and a patron of poets, had a little competition. They each wrote a poem about the head that had been found, the head that had been discovered in Egypt. And Horace Smith's poem.
Yeah, I remember the title of this is
rather unfortunate title. Right? Yeah. On a stupendous leg of granite discovered standing by itself in the deserts of Egypt, with the inscription inserted below.
I'm already bored before the title.
Yeah, it's not a. It did not live, that poem. But Shelley's did, and Ozymandias is one of his most famous poems, I would say, maybe along with Mont Blanc and Ode to the West Wind.
Yeah,
it is.
And it's one of the most famous poems in the language, frankly. Mm-hmm. So he heard about this statue, had yet to come to England, but he also heard about an inscription written. And what was the inscription exactly?
Yeah, the inscription comes from a Roman-era historian named Diodorus Siculus, who had described a statue of a pharaoh named Ozymandias. That's the Greek name for the guy who's more commonly known as Ramses II. Mm-hmm. Who could be the pharaoh referred to in the Book of Exodus? We don't know. This is from the 13th century before the Common Era. And so Diodorus reports that the inscription on the statue, which he said was the biggest statue in Egypt, he reports that the inscription was, "King of kings, Ozymandias am I. If any want to know how great I am and where I lie, let him outdo me in my work."
And that's what got Shelley all excited, and that's why he wrote this poem. Let's hear it now. Several years ago, we asked the actor Michael Stuhlbarg to read it for us.
Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
That was Michael Stuhlbarg reading Shelley's sonnet Ozymandias. Let's go through it more slowly. It begins very romantically. So many romantic poems could have begun like this. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, And then the rest of the poem is the traveler himself elaborately describing a statue in ruins. Why does he frame it like this? Why doesn't he just have the traveler tell his tale?
Mm-hmm. Interesting question, and it's a real feint, F-E-I-N-T. It's a trick that Shelley plays by beginning the sonnet with the word I. There really is no I in the poem. This is just a quick framing device, and then there's a further frame that is the I and then the traveler, and then we have the monument. And the monument, of course, is meant to somehow sum up the king. So we go through these different frames of the poem further and further. And what do we find at the center? It turns out we find nothing. When Shelley says near the end of the poem, we'll get there when we get there, but he says, nothing beside remains. What he means that there's nothing around the statue, but there's really the statue itself is a kind of nothing. When the king says, in the words of the inscription,
my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.
Well, it's a ruin. It's a big nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's the big irony of the poem. Okay, let's go back to the beginning of what the traveler says. It's a description of Ozymandias' sculpted face.
Half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed.
There's a lot packed into those mm-hmm. lines. That's really mm-hmm. the heart of the sonnet right mm-hmm. there. Can you unpack it a bit?
Well, one thing that's interesting here, and a thing that readers tend to stumble over, is why is the sculptor in the poem?
Yeah.
Why should we care about the sculptor? First of all, we have this immense, savage undermining of this tyrant pharaoh's commanding visage, right, as it's supposed to be. The visage is shattered, and the frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command, it's reduced to fragments. But the sculptor... tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. Okay, so the passions of the pharaoh that are stamped on the lifeless sculpture. But then this line, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed.
Yeah, that's the most baffling line of the sonnet.
Yeah, especially the heart that fed, phrase. The hand that mocked them. Well, here you have to remember that the word mocked means two things. It means, in a neutral sense, it means simply to describe something. Shakespeare uses it in this sense, so that when an artist draws something or paints something.
To mock up something.
To mock up, yeah, exactly. But here, it of course has the other sense as well. That is, that the artist a court sculptor who's doing an official job, and presumably the pharaoh was very pleased with this rendition of him. In fact, he doesn't look so bad, by the way. And, Ramses II doesn't seem to have a sneer of cold command. He looks like he's a very appealing...
little poetic license right there. Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, Shelley didn't see the statue. But, so the sculptor reads those passions within him, right, within the pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also mocking those passions, right? He realizes that those passions are futile, that they're furious, but, basically empty.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of Shelley's attitude towards tyrants in general. He thought of George III as his tyrant, mm-hmm. right? George III was ruling England at the time.
And Shelley was a radical Democrat.
He was a radical Democrat and an atheist. In fact, he... at Oxford, he had written a pamphlet called The Necessity of Atheism. His children with his first wife were taken away from him and sent to a foster home because he was an atheist.
Mm.
Around this time...
He's a martyr to atheism.
He was a martyr to atheism, yeah. And Shelley also, a little bit after this, wrote another great poem, England in 1819, in which he excoriates George III as an old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king.
Wow.
And he describes the situation of the people. A group of protesters had just been killed in the Peterloo Massacre by British soldiers. A people starved and stabbed in the untilled field. You know, so it's a tremendously powerful poem about the, as Shelley sees it, the tyrant who is ruling England. So this is the same subject as Ozymandias, except that in the case of Ozymandias, everything is taken away. There's no populace, there's no masses of people around him.
His power isn't there anymore. All that's left is this weird record of him lying in shards on the desert floor.
Yeah, he's a relic.
But by bringing in the sculptor, isn't he comparing political power to the power of art? And isn't there some kind of contest going on here?
Yes, that is the contest. And of course, Shelley himself, he was not only a radical Democrat, but he was also a messianic thinker. He was someone who wanted to remake human nature. He wanted to save the human race. He wanted to refound who we are and what we do, you know, on newly humane principles.
He failed.
And he failed in these, as you might have noticed, he failed in this aim, but he was very serious about it. Yeah. I mean, he was a revolutionary top to toe with every fiber of his being. This was his intense prophetic quality. You know, he saw himself as a prophet. And as we know from the Hebrew Bible, you know, the prophets see themselves as much more powerful in the true sense of powerful than kings. You know, they are the ones who really know what justice is. They are the ones who are demanding the right, and that's the way that that Shelley saw himself.
But how is he seeing the sculptor in the poem?
The sculptor in the poem, I think, is someone who clearly has no choice. That is, the sculptor is, we don't know who the sculptor was, number one. The sculptor is not like Shelley in the sense that, you know, Shelley had written poems that called for revolution, poems that called for the overturning of this corrupt, desiccated order that was ruling Europe, ruling the whole world, really, in Shelley's own day. But in this poem, we have a sculptor who simply does his work, but in a way, it's not so simple. The hand that mocked them—that is what the sculptor is doing—is not just honoring the king. That's what he's paid for, but also mocking him or insulting him by making it clear that this sneer of cold command is really what this pharaoh is all about. And
the sculptor got it in there without Ozymandias realizing that he was being mocked.
Exactly.
It's like a portraitist of Stalin putting a sneer on his face or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. So as we all know, we have certain leaders who like to appear scowling. This is
yes. I don't know who you're referring to.
Perhaps this is somehow fancied to be a Churchillian or dignified scowl.
Right.
But in this case, the cold command is something that's it's the vehicle of a deep irony, a profound irony. That is, there's nothing there to command.
Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
So here's the question. How is Shelley the poet writing this poem not like the sculptor who seemed to delight in mocking Ozymandias? Isn't Shelley also mocking Ozymandias?
Well, what Shelley is doing here, I think, is showing us how the boasts of tyrants simply echo in the echo chamber of history, you know, down the centuries. But there's a necessary irony to them and a necessary emptiness to them that when Ozymandias says, or, you know, when the monument says in the name of Ozymandias, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair," no one is going to obey this command. No one looks on these works and despairs.
Now it's a joke. Now it's an ironic joke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It becomes an ironic joke. And then when he goes on to say, "Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away," that's the punchline. The punchline is this empty landscape. Just as the poem, by the way, was read by Walter White towards the end of Breaking Bad, towards the end of that that remarkable TV series, and we had exactly the same point.
Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
What are your ambitions, your vainglory, when matched with the desert of the Southwest, which stretches on, and you're just a tiny figure in that landscape?
But doesn't that beg the question, we're all in that desert. All human accomplishment amounts to nothing in the long course of time. So what is Shelley's poem telling us about that dilemma? It could be, you could be a tyrant and have power beyond the seas, or you could be just an ordinary person. Everything we do is going to be washed away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's his response to that?
Well, his response really has to be found in other poems. And, you know, I mean, Shelley really has two basic modes, and this poem is in neither of those modes. One of his modes is this very delicate, very lucid evocation of the ephemeral workings of the spirit, you know, as they pass over the human being. And particularly in his final poems, Shelley was dead about 4 years after he wrote this poem, just a month short of his 30th birthday. Mm. And so he died, he was youthful. He was a youthful poet. And we have that sense of the spring-like quality of youth, the vividness, the supple beauty of youth in those delicate lyrics. Mm-hmm. So that's one mode. But then the other mode was a transcendental challenge to everything that we see and know around us. And, you know, we think this is true. What is true? The stock exchange, the factory, the king, wealthy people, you know, the miseries of the working class. These are not truths, according to Shelley. These are shackles. These are a form of bondage, and we have to burst through. And how do we burst through? Well, one way is, for example, in the poem Mont Blanc. He says that Mont Blanc, the mountain in the Alps, the mountain hath a voice to repeal vast codes of fraud and woe.
Hmm.
Which means that, you know, attend this mountain, take in the sublime.
A very
face
romantic
of this mountain.
View. Yeah. Get into nature.
Yeah. And then somehow this sublime scene will, fire through and devastate all of those codes of fraud and woe that rule us now. So, you know, that's the transcendent Shelley. And, mm-hmm. and that is his answer. It proved to be an answer that, it wasn't put into action. And, at some level, of course, Shelley didn't expect it to, at least not in his lifetime.
But it was taken up with a vengeance by American transcendentalists like Emerson and others.
Yeah, for sure. And Emerson, I mean, Shelley has, it's interesting when I teach Shelley because I sometimes ask my classes, who do you prefer, Keats or Shelley? And not a single person ever says Shelley. But I think that's because Keats is thought of as the more humane, the more ordinary poet, the poet who has a feeling for us.
Hmm.
And Shelley, it seems to them, does not. I mean, Shelley always wants us to stretch beyond who we are. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants to look beyond, and he does look beyond. And so in that desolate scene at the end of Ozymandias, we get that desolation, that bareness. And in this case, there's no transcendent answer. But we still have the same sort of alien landscape that we do often in Shelley, you know, in his transcendent poems.
We should say as a footnote, there was an article that came out in The Guardian that I saw last year saying that in Egypt, they had found what they now think of as the statue of Ozymandias, Ramses III.
Yes.
He survives even today.
Yeah. We're still talking about him. I don't know if that would have made him happy, but...
Yeah, and we're still talking about Shelley. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read David Micke's poem guide to Ozymandias on our website. David's books include Slow Reading in a Hurried Age and Bellows People. We love getting emails with your comments and suggestions. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org or write a review of the podcast in Apple Podcasts. And please link to the podcast on social media. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.